From KHOI in Story City, Ames, I'm Chris Viviora, and this is Book Central, the show that interviews authors from the Central Time Zone. My guest today is Benjamin Percy, author of the new book of essays about writing fiction titled Thrill Me. Ben excavates the intersection of genres, readability, and literary storytelling. Ben used to teach at Iowa State University, where he served as my mentor my first year in the Master's in Fine Arts program in Creative Writing and Environment. Now, Ben lives in Minnesota and writes full-time. Benjamin Percy, welcome to Book Central.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
Ben, you grew up as a reader of popular literature, and there's one book in particular that you cleaved to during a formative time of your life. How did you use that book as a portal?
Well, the book is Stephen King's The Gunslinger, the first of the Dark Tower series, and I read that at a kind of critical time. I was in junior high and in a lot of trouble, so I was busted for vandalism, busted for shoplifting, I'd been suspended several times for fighting, and I was just kind of a hormonal mess. And part of the reason for this was, not to make excuses, I was a little terrorist. But part of the reason was, we'd moved all around. And I was always the new kid. I was in eight different schools as a kid. So, at this, you walk into an environment like middle school, which is, 13 is the worst year of anybody's life. And, it can bring out the worst in you. So, I read, my parents were about to send me to a different school, one where I could get a fresh start. And in the summer, in between 7th and 8th grade, I read The Gunslinger, and it had, as corny as it sounds, a sort of instrumental effect on my sense of manhood. So, I looked to Roland, the titular gunslinger, as, he's sort of a Clint Eastwood type. He's a knight of sorts. He has a code of honor, and yet he's in this, other world that sort of resembles a, man with no name Western. So, I might as well have had WWRD tattooed on my forearm the way that some kids have, the WWJD tattooed there. What would Roland do? I started to think, very seriously about, how would he behave, what sort of decisions he would make in any given moment, and that ended up, sort of changing who I was. I became much more withdrawn socially, and more of a leader at the same time, sort of, cracking down on people misbehaving around me, and becoming, obsessively studious, and, became a straight-A student thereafter, and, probably was a lot less fun in the years to follow, but still, it very much shaped who I was. I think that's true to a less dramatic degree.
That it was kind of like it was kind of like your anecdote to, isolation of being the new kid that you could fill in a role.
That's true, yeah. There's something aspirational about, being the stranger who rides into town and shakes things up now.
Sure, and I found it compelling that you grew up reading Stephen King, because he says that he wants people to read his books at least twice. The first time, he wants readers' full attention for the story, and then he wants them to reread it, to perhaps discover something more in the writing. So, what are your desires for your readers?
I want to, educate, I want to incite, I want to entertain, to thrill, I want to instruct. It's, it depends sometimes on what I'm writing.
Sure.
As I, cross so many different mediums. And the goal of every piece is not the same. But, generally speaking, I want this world to fade away and for them to fall down the rabbit hole of my mind and be somewhere else for a while.
The narrative dream kind of John Gardner talks about. And in your book, you say that you want people, at least in fiction, to be asking what's next, to make it a page-turner, but also to be influenced and engaged with the character, to get to know that character, maybe like how you got to know Roland, maybe even become Roland.
Yeah, what happens next is the most critical question. That's why people read. And that's something that, you know, I lost touch with over the years of taking so many creative writing workshops.
Sure. But when you were younger, I was pretty envious to read that you regularly journeyed to the Shangri-La of books, Powell's in Portland, Oregon. I even went there on my honeymoon, actually several times when we visited Portland. But you grew up going there as a kid. So what was that like as a new reader or becoming a reader? Can you tell me about what room pulled you in?
Yeah, well, everybody knows Powell's these days because of its major online presence. That's, you know, I'm not just fond of, but worshipful of the store itself, the downtown store at Burnside and 10th, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, it's a giant concrete sarcophagus, and you can spend days there, seemingly. We lived in rural Oregon and didn't really have any options besides a crappy Walden books in the mall, and so we would, you know, make a pilgrimage every few months. My grandmother lived in Portland.
Okay.
We'd also go to Powell's, and we'd be there for 6 hours. And you know, I was especially taken by the mass market paperback with the embossed title, and the place that I would find that was colorblind in my memory. I think it's the Gold Room. I know exactly where it is. You walk in, go to the left,
mm-hmm.
travel through two rooms, and that space, which contained all the, you know, horror novels and the fantasy and sci-fi novels, you know, it's just I can smell it right now. It's like the earthwormy smell. It's a little bit away from the windows, so it's shadow soaked, and you know that is really one of my favorite places in the world. And we would, you know, stock up on this Dark Tower, I guess you could say, of novels, those mass market paperbacks, and bring them back to Central Oregon. And I know this sounds really romantic,
mm-hmm.
But we would spend every evening just about as a family reading in the living room together. Not reading aloud, but
yeah.
each with our faces stuffed into our own respective novels.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty important to share reading together. Like you said, maybe not out loud, but as a family, that each of y'all could have your own books, your own world to escape into, but still have that world of literacy together. I mean, that's why I married my wife, is that she's a reader, and we ended up going to Portland for a food festival, but I think we spent more time at Powell's than at the food festival.
It's the mothership.
Yeah, that was the first time I'd ever been there, and that would be heaven or a place to worship for sure. And you read all these kind of mass paperbacks. You read Westerns, thrillers, fantasy, and then horror. And horror is where you say you wanted to relive the nightmare. How did feeling afraid bring you a rush to live? I mean, you were kind of a terrible little kid to your sister, but what was it about being scared or scaring other people that gave you this rush of life?
It's just the way I'm hardwired, incorrectly. and I don't know, you know, some of it stemmed from when I was a kid and maybe boredom, just terrorizing my sister. She had, you know, these troll dolls with the wild hair and the bug eyes, my arms sticking straight out. I would, you know, rearrange them at night, and they would be holding notes that said things like bad dreams, R and the S backwards for trollish authenticity, and I developed this whole mythology about the roof people, and to this day, you know, I take great pride in the fact that she still sleeps the light on.
Yeah.
Even though she's now in her 30s. And, you know, I've having grown up, I'm still that obnoxious big brother, in a way, because you know, my son had a Halloween party last night.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, some friends over, and they were playing Ghost in the Graveyard, They were watching Ghostbusters, the original, for the first time. And I put on a gorilla suit, and I crept around the house, and smashed up against the living room window, pounding and hooting and howling. And, you know, they all went into cardiac arrest. That made me very happy. You know, there's just something about Stephen King puts it there in the nightmare that, you know, the horror film or the horror novel is the equivalent of stepping onto a roller coaster, you know, and feeling that thrill that there's, you know, nothing that makes you feel more alive in a way than putting your foot over some precipice and drawing it back, and staring into the abyss.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't write horror exclusively, but it's, you know, it's something that's of great interest to me.
Sure. Yeah, you became kind of this reader led to it, maybe for the thrill of living. And I'd like to say that your sister's first book was called Demon Camp. but maybe a nod to you.
Keep it in the family.
Yeah, keep it in the family. But you alluded to this earlier, that so when you were a kid, you just loved reading. You could read these thrilling books. And then there was a time during graduate school that you felt bored as a writer, and maybe also as a reader, and then you discovered a book, actually an anthology, that enchanted you. Would you tell me about that book and how it cast its spell on you, maybe how it continues to influence your writing?
Sure. So I had, you know, growing up on books with dragons and barbarians with woolly underwear and flaming swords on the cover. Growing up with books with skeletons and vampires and robots with laser eyes on the covers. And that's what I wanted to write when I stepped into that first creative writing workshop. But when I sat down and the professor went through the syllabus, what he said was no genre.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really know what he meant by that. I didn't know that there really was such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't distinguish between these categories. And you know, I thereafter discovered all these wonderful writers who I'd never heard of. I'd never heard of Flannery O'Connor or James Baldwin or Annie Poole or Alice Munro. I'd never heard of Raymond Carver.
Mm.
And, you know, I read and wrote literary fiction almost exclusively for the next few years until I happened upon that book by Michael Chabon, and it's called Thrilling Tales, and it's edited by him. It came out first as a McSweeney's volume, and then they you know, reprinted it through Vintage. And the idea behind it was that Michael Chabon assigned to all of the authors in this anthology the kind of story they would have loved to read when growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And so Sherman Alexie wrote a story about zombie Native Americans rising up against a redneck sheriff. And, you know, Amy Bender's in there, and Kelly Link's in there, and Nick Hornby's got a story in there about a magic VCR that can see into the future, and Jim Shepard's got a story in there about a giant shark. And they, you know, the stories are sort of hit or miss, but the spirit behind it enchanted me. Especially that opening essay that Michael Chabon wrote, where he said that he was a bored reader, that he was a bored writer, and this is a guy at the apex of his career.
Mm-hmm.
And that idea struck home in part because my wife returned a book to me. I was trying to push books on her, and she said, "I will never read another book that you recommend." And it's not because she didn't like the book itself, it's because of what I did to the book. You know, the pages were just corralled with what looked like barbed wire. I had written so many notes inside of, you know, a novel or a book of short stories because I was figuring out how sentences worked, how paragraphs worked, how scenes worked.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "You take the fun out of reading." And, you know, I was thinking about that at the time. I was thinking about how I had sort of lost touch with why I wanted to become a writer. And so when I read that book by Michael Chabon, I started to ask myself, you know, what if he had invited me to be part of this anthology,
mm-hmm.
what story would I have written?
Yeah.
And that, you know, just that question changed everything for me. Mm-hmm. And in a way, I've been writing that story ever since.
Yeah, it was like you finally kind of found your conversation, that someone else was going to listen and maybe that they were going to speak to you as well. That's pretty...
Yeah, well, just the idea that, you know, there are these, you know, there's nothing wrong with being artful, with writing pretty sentences. There's certainly nothing wrong with writing three-dimensional characters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's one of my central aims, is to make the reader feel as though these characters made of ink and paper are alive. But I think the literary fiction fetishizes that sometimes so much, especially the pretty sentences thing, that they lose track of why people read. And there is nothing wrong with being on sort of like two planes at once, that plane of, you know, composition where you can sort of see everything encoded, where you can understand the way that stories are put together and, you know, have this groundswell theme and exquisite metaphors strewn all throughout. But, you know, and there's nothing wrong with writers. I love writers like Joy Williams and Lydia Davis and Donald Barthelme, who are sort of only writing for those who are at that same level.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing wrong with that, but I feel like there's been this sort of huddling, you know, this circling of the wagons in the academy. And they've excluded anything that might stink of plot,
mm-hmm.
or reek of genre. And, you know, I think that you can be both art, you know, you can have a story that's both artfully told and compulsively readable. Look at Margaret Atwood. Look at, you know, Octavia Butler. Look at Peter Straub or Dan Simmons or Dennis Lehane and Dan Shaun. And you'll see, you know, you'll see that there are so many stories out there that are incorporating speculative elements, that are making you want to turn the pages so swiftly to make a breeze. But if you slow down and look at, you know, those sentences, you could pluck out any one of them and frame it and hang it on the wall and, you know, invite the neighbors over to admire.
Right. We should be writers that we want to read, and also reading writers that we want to read. And that's great to be able to find that, again, that conversation to be a part of. We're going to continue our conversation a little bit here. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Book Central. Support for this program is provided by Plot Twist Bookstore in Ankeny, a place where book lovers can browse, talk, and meet. Open daily. For hours and more information, go to plottwistbookstore.com. We're back. If you're just joining me, my guest today is Benjamin Percy, author of Thrill Me, his collection of essays about writing fiction. Before the break, we were talking about his journey of becoming a reader, losing the path, and then finding it again on the borderlands of genre and literary writing. Ben, at first in college as an undergrad, you studied archaeology because you wanted to adventure like Indiana Jones, but the coursework didn't quite turn out that fun. However, years later now, in Thrill Me, you write about designing suspense by digging into Jones as a character in Raiders of the Lost Ark. Perhaps you're finally getting an adventure like him, but in writing. How are Jones's fears and desires in Raiders a model for writing worst-case scenarios?
Yeah, I mean, I really did want to be Harrison Ford, and that dream dissolved. But I still have the hat. Still have the hat. And but when it comes to worst-case scenarios, it's just another way to model a narrative. If you think about most creative writing manuals that you'll come across, they talk about this thing called the Freytag Triangle, and Freytag Triangle, I don't know how it's pronounced. And the idea is that you have sort of this upside-down checkmark, and there is a series of battles that are rising toward the biggest battle of all, the apex of your story, the summit of your story. And there's another way to think about it, and that is that your character is experiencing a series of failures, moving towards the biggest failure of all. And I try to think about the long game whenever I write a big story, a novel, a screenplay, and or even, you know, a lengthy story arc in a comic series. And, you know, you want to have your end game in mind. And most people have in mind, you know, that higher order goal, which might be, you know, give the ring to Mordor, to, you know, cast it back into the fiery chasm from whence it came, or it might be, you know, stop the zombie virus, or, you know, figure out who the serial killer is, or whatever.
Or get the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah, get the Ark of the Covenant. But the idea is that there, you know, is a major failure that occurs typically at the juncture of the second and third act, especially when it comes to film. And, you know, I realize very well that film and novels are different animals, but they do have the same skeletal structure. So this moment in film is called The Dark Night of the Soul, or All is Lost.
Mm-hmm.
And what you'll usually see is that this has been set up from the very beginning of the story. So with Indiana Jones, you have that Raiders of the Lost Ark specifically, you have that amazing opening set piece, where he's wandering through the jungle, and, you know, some of his men have already betrayed him, and he's shown them the business, you know, by swatting that gun pistol out of their hand with his whip, and, you know, they're heading into this cave full of tarantulas, and, you know, make it through a series of booby traps, and finally get that idol, right, and he busts out of the cave, and he immediately has that encounter with Belloc, which is essential because Belloc is, you know, if you think about it, there's always two forces. Like, there's the force of good, and there's, except as corny as it sounds, the force of evil.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It
mm-hmm.
might be like the Shire and Mordor. It might be the Cinderella and the evil stepmother. It might be Batman and the Joker. And you have, you know, these opposing forces, and usually the best villains, and I know that, again, that word sounds corny, but
mm-hmm.
The best villains are either a dark mirror or an opposite of the protagonist. In the case of Belloc, who swipes that, you know, golden idol away from Indiana Jones and makes it his own, you know, he is a dark mirror.
Hmm.
He is somebody who has studied, as Jones had. He's highly intelligent, very cultured, travels the world, runs in the same circles, but he's motivated by commerce and power. Whereas all Jones wants is, you know, to appreciate archaeology, to preserve archaeology. His sort of tagline all throughout those movies is that this belongs in a museum.
Mm.
And so Belloc swipes that away, and we immediately get something seated there when it comes to, you know, the story arc, that there's somebody else who is in contest with Indiana Jones and wants things for different reasons. So that sets up something I want to talk about in a bit. But the other thing that gets set up there is that Indiana Jones pounds through the jungle, escaping from Belloc, who sets his natives upon him. And they're shooting their poison darts, and Indiana Jones barely makes it after swinging on a vine into this single-engine plane. And as it takes off, he looks down at his feet, and there is a python curled around his ankles. And he freaks out and says, you know, Jack, there's a snake in the plane, Jack.
Says, oh, that's just my pet snake, Reggie.
And he says, I hate snakes, Jack. I hate them. And, you know, Jack says, show them a backbone. And, you know, there you have a setup of a fear.
Mm-hmm.
The character's weakness. Every character has a weakness. They have, sometimes that weakness is connected to a secret as well. So, if you think about that series of failures, you know, you have a higher order goal to a narrative. A higher order goal is get the arc. And the antagonistic force is the Nazis, but they are working with Belloc.
Mm-hmm.
So the Nazis are sort of the big bad, and Belloc is, in a way, a henchman of sorts. And so, you know, this adventure sets off, and what you have is, as always, like when you're creating a narrative, you want to be, as author, you want to be a cruel god who is setting obstacles in the way of your character's desire.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he eventually does figure out where the arc is after many mishaps along the way. And it is in the Tomb of Lost Souls. So the Nazis are digging on a different mountainside, a different hillside, and he's digging on another, and you know, it's a stormy night, and he and his buddy Sala, you know, they crowbar up this tomb, and, you know, they're in the ceiling of it, and all these sort of unholy gases spew out, and they throw down into the belly of this tomb a torch, and the torch is moving after it hits the floor. And they realize it's because it's full of snakes. And Sala says, asps, very dangerous. You go first, Indy. And so Indy, you know, ropes down, and he's horrified of snakes. We know this. And immediately, you know, a cobra rises up in front of his face. They make it through the snakes, this gauntlet of snakes, and get the arc. And a little bit of nerd trivia here. In the hieroglyphics on the wall, you can see R2-D2 and C-3PO.
Oh.
And, you know, the arc comes out, and it's glowing, and they rope it up, and, you know, it seems as though everything is going great. But the rope falls back down after Sala makes it up, and he's going to be surrounded by snakes, and you know, he's like, what's going on? And there are the Nazis grinning down on him. And Belloc, you know, Belloc saying, hello down there, as he waves his hat. And, you know, he is sealed in at that moment. They throw down, what's her name, Karen Carpenter, Miriam, and they seal them in. And what's happened, the worst-case scenario has happened. He has lost his higher order goal. He has lost the Ark of the Covenant to the Nazis, to Belloc. Once again, that golden item has been pulled right from his hand. And he's surrounded by 100,000 asps in this dark tomb. So, worst case scenario, and this always happens in a story. You know, they get to that moment where it seems as though they can't possibly go on.
And stories
and
are
maybe it's,
so stories are about that forward movement. And with Indy, what's really interesting, and you know, giving kind of the narrative right there, there's not a lot of background of his character. I guess you figure it out throughout the movie, and you mentioned this, that you take issue with background. Some beginning writers get stuck on backgrounds instead of staying in their narrative moment. So why should writers fold the past into the present? I guess how can they do that?
Yeah, well, I see a lot of bombastic things in the book, and one of them is, you know, eliminate backstory. Now, with that said, you know, there should be an asterisk next to it, because, you know, I use backstory, and I guess I'm trying to be loud and obnoxious in the hopes that people will, you know, maybe meet me halfway.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I see a lot of manuscripts at writers' conferences, or when I've taught in the past at colleges and universities, I just see this, you know, dependence on backstory, where sometimes it feels like the only reason the story exists is backstory. And sometimes it seems like the backstory is interfering with the forward momentum of the piece. Like every time it moves forward a few steps, then we go back in time again. It moves forward a few steps, then we go back in time again. It's this start-stop quality through it all. So I think that in general you can avoid backstory by, hinting at it in the present. The way Indiana Jones and Belloc already have a relationship. It's not the first time they've met when they're outside that cave and he swipes the golden idol from his hand.
Sure. So
they've had a long professional, personal relationship. And we don't have to, everything doesn't have to go wavy right then. And, sentimental music start in as we go back in time to this gauzy moment when Belloc and Indiana Jones were, taking their final PhD exam and Belloc was peering over into the shoulder and stealing some of the answers. We don't need that. It's implied in the way that they're interacting with each other in the present. So, I think that if you can, try to make that happen. Try to make the past, there's that whole metaphor of the iceberg that Ernest Hemingway talks about, how, a story is like an iceberg that, you see just this, I don't know how much of an iceberg is beneath the surface, something like 6/8 or 7/8, and you just see that top 8. And in the same way, for your characters and their backstories, you should know all of this stuff yourself when you're writing it, but maybe you should imply a lot of it instead of including an exhaustive Wikipedia entry on everything that's happened to your character previous to the story beginning.
And backstory can be used at a lull in narrative to foreshadow action, though. I mean, there's an amazing moment of reversal towards the end of Jaws when the men have retired to the belly of the boat. You could tell me about that moment, how it shows a glimmer of light before the crashing darkness. That's maybe the ideal of throwing in some backstory.
Sure, yeah. I mean, that's one of my favorite moments in film, which is when the men are gathered in the belly of the ship and they're talking about scars. And they're laughing and they're drinking whiskey and, for the first time, really, getting along. So you have Richard Dreyfuss, the marine biologist, you have Robert Shaw, who plays Captain Quint, and you have Roy Scheider, who's playing Chief Brody. And so these people have all been at odds, even though they're united in the same goal, which is to take down the shark. But this moment, they're going back and forth, and, he's talking about, I can't bend this elbow because there's an arm wrestling contest in an Oki bar in San Francisco, and this guy pulled him right over and snapped his arm, and, Richard Dreyfuss has this scar from a thresher shark, and Roy Scheider, one of my favorite quiet moments in film as well, Roy Scheider's laughing and watching all this and not really participating, but he pulls up his shirt right then and has an appendectomy scar. Uh-huh. He chooses not to say anything about it. He just puts the shirt back down because he knows he's lame compared to these guys. And anyways, they're laughing, and there's this great reversal right in the moment of that scene where here they are giggling away in a state of undress, and then everything gets really scary. And everything gets really scary in part because we were laughing the moment before. We're emotionally vulnerable. It's like that seesaw effect.
Mm-hmm.
You see that in horror movies a lot where, somebody will be, rolling around in the hayloft, having some fun. And that's when the monster strikes. Or, somebody will be making a joke, and then that's when their head gets lopped off. So this moment, it's a great emotional reversal in that Chief Brody says, "What about that one?" And Robert Shaw says, "That's a tattoo I got removed."
Hmm.
And Richard Dreyfuss says, let me guess, mother. Gets off into a giggling fit. And Robert Shaw says, "Oh, Hooper, that's the USS Indianapolis." And everything gets really quiet. And he says, "You were on the Indianapolis?" And he launches into this incredible monologue about how he was on the USS Indianapolis when it delivered the bomb, the Hiroshima bomb, on a mission so secret nobody knew where they were. And so when two Japanese torpedoes knocked out that ship and it sank, they were at sea for, I can't remember how many days, but like a week, just treading water. And the sharks came in and took them out one by one. And that's where you get that whole moment about a shark's eyes are like doll's eyes, black and lifeless. And, it's horrifying for the reasons I said before, because it's an emotional reversal, but it's also horrifying because you understand why Robert Shaw has been pursuing the shark, mm-hmm. such fury. You know, he is Ahab. Mm. He's seeking justice. You know, all those men got picked off by the sharks, and now he's going to kill this shark or die trying. And, you know, it really is an Ahab quality. So you understand, you know, who the character is in that moment. And that's an unnecessary sort of moment of repose, like it starts to move. And you need to take a breather every now and then. So mm-hmm. just the reason to look there to propulsion, it's a good idea. But it's not backstory in a standard sense. It doesn't, like, flash back. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a moment in the present. It's a revelation in the present that is affecting the present moment. And changing the way that these guys sort of view their expedition, maybe with even more horror, and view their associate, you know, with greater trepidation and respect at the same time, realizing that he's actually, you know, not only, completely admirable, awesome guy for surviving all of this, but, you know, he's a lunatic as well, and he might bring them all down with him.
Exactly. That's the point, is that we want to make the past present. We're going to take another short break here. You're listening to Book Central. This program is supported by Humanities Iowa and the National Endowment for the Humanities. The views and opinions expressed by this program do not necessarily reflect those of Humanities Iowa or the National Endowment for the Humanities. And I'm back with Benjamin Percy. Ben, welcome back to the show.
Yeah.
We're going to hop ahead here to talk a little bit about you as a writer. If anyone gets to know you as a writer, then they get to know that you're a writer who works, who doesn't give up and continues. You wrote at least 4 failed novels before getting a fixer-upper novel picked up as your debut. You had every page of a short story in grad school X'd out, and your professor only gave you 1 comment scrawled on the last page. It read, "Don't." You once said a story out 39 times before it was published. I want to talk about all that perseverance, but I first want to ask you about what gets left behind. What are some of the parts from the junkyard, or as you say, corpses from the cemetery? And how did you exhume and charge these pieces back to life?
Well, one thing that makes people nervous about revision is that they've worked so hard on this thing, and how can they possibly cut this paragraph or cut this page or cut this chapter or scrap the whole thing? And if you write long enough, you understand that there's always more timber coming down the trail. But another thing that really helped me was creating a folder called The Graveyard. And because some of the listeners are undoubtedly less morbid than I am, call it the compost heap or something, because the idea is the same, that if you're discarding something, you find a place for it in your graveyard. You go to this folder, and I have all these files stacked up like tombstones, and they have titles like descriptions of nature, or dialogue interactions, or settings, or whatever. sometimes I'll label a file according to, like, the larger novel project from which I've cut these things. Anyways, whatever I've cut, I plunk in there. Now, every time I start a new project, I go back to the graveyard and revisit some old friends, lay down some flowers, and occasionally I see something there, and I'm like, ooh, I could use that.
And you dig them up.
That liver, or that femur, or that eyeball, or whatever. And, you know, by calling down the lightning and bringing these things back to life, you know, not only, you know, scavenging some quality nuggets because my previous drafts might have not have been total losers. They might have overall been failures, but, you know, they had some things in them that were shining, that were worth holding on to. And it just reassures me when I am cutting in the future. It just makes it that much easier to do as Faulkner demands and kill your darlings when you know that there's a place for them. So I think for psychological reasons, even if you're never going to use anything in that graveyard, it makes the revision process easier. So, you know, in The Wilding, for instance, that's my first published novel. I used something from a previous failed novel.
Mm.
And that was this anecdote that my in-laws have a hunting cabin, and, you know, it's missing a chimney cap. It's a bit of a rustic place. And everybody's gathered around in a living room one evening, sipping whiskey. It's cold out, and all of a sudden there's this boom in the fireplace as something falls from above and lands on the fire and sends sparks everywhere. There's this unholy screeching, and it's an owl that rises up from the flames, and the owl is passed out from the smoke as it was on the chimney for the heat.
Mm.
And then it just fainted and fell into the fire, and it rises up with its feathers cindering and screeching and flies throughout the room, and everybody's screaming and on the floor, and eventually somebody opens up the door and the owl goes flapping off into the night.
Mm.
Right, so great moment. Tried to use it in one of my terrible novels. A terrible novel did not get published. Put it into The Wilding, and it went the distance.
And your father-in-law plays a pretty influential role in Thrill Me. He's a worker, and it's neat to hear about his influence on you. How did he help you understand the method of writing as work?
Well, he's a dairy farmer. That works hard on anybody. I know. Wakes up at 4:30 every morning. Ashes at 10 every night. Works all day. He has intermittent breaks, but that guy works hard. And work informs his life. You know, when he's going down a county highway in his car, he's a bit distracted because he's always staring at what other people are doing. He's trying to figure out how high their corn is. You know, if it's July or August, you know, or if it's May, he's saying, is the corn up yet? You know, as he's going around, he's trying to figure out if the first green shoots have popped up. You know, he's trying to figure out if it's the fall, who's finished their fields yet, or who got a new grain bin. So the car is always, like, all over the place if he's driving. And, you know, I used to, if you just think about that one instance, which is one instance of many, but I used to drive past farms without even really looking at them. They were just a blur in the periphery of my vision. And now I notice what's going on in the fields. I can track the seasons according to the fields. And I am able to, you know, pick out different pieces of equipment to know, you know, what implement dealer they went to. I know about the process. You know, I still have a lot to learn, but I know about agricultural process enough that I'm just attuned to this new way of seeing all because of him and my in-laws more generally. So, you know, I started to think about this in relation to my stories and how they, you know, a lot of stories that I read in workshops, the characters have no job, or they have a job that's just briefly mentioned, and otherwise there's no relevance in the story. But most of it, we're not dairy farmers, but all of us have that same mindset. You know, if you're in advertising, you see everything as copy. You know, you see the billboards all around you, or pay special attention to those radio breaks and, you know, commercial breaks when you're watching TV. You are thinking about everything as a potential material in some way, maybe as a novelist or a poet. Or if you're a war vet, if you're a fashion model, if you're a piano mover, if you're a whatever, like that's how you encounter the world and label the world. That's the language that you use is influenced by your job. You know, whether you like it or not, work defines us. So I'm pushing people to think about that in their stories. And it's become one of the greatest pleasures of writing for me, because every time I write a novel or a short story or a screenplay, I'm thinking about that job and I'm researching it, spending time with these people, spending time with a taxidermist or spending time with a politician or spending time with an FBI agent, spending time with a Marine, trying to figure out what makes them tick, trying to figure out that insider terminology. And, I get to live many different lives as a result of this.
So you get this influence of all these other working lives because that's where we spend our lives the most, at work. That completely makes sense to writing because we're going to be spending our time on the page. And you kind of got your start spending some time on the page with quite a bit of encouragement by a couple people in your life who gave you permission to write. Two of these were women. Would you tell me about how as a kid you accepted being different, and then as an adult, how the person you loved helped you love writing?
Well, I think primarily of my wife when I think of, that encouragement to hammer the keyboard, because we were working at Glacier National Park. She was my then-girlfriend, working at the dining hall as a waitress, and I was a gardener. And I was, one gardening, one planting geraniums and mowing the lawn and watering the pots in Mary Glacier Lodge. I was also pushing words around in my head because I was off writing songs, I was writing love letters, I was writing journal entries. I would slip these love letters into her mailbox, Lisa's mailbox, employee mailbox. And one night when we were watching the sunset over the Rockies, she said, "You should be a writer." And I said, "Okay." Prior to that, I was thinking seriously about becoming an archaeologist. That dream had mostly dissolved. That's why I was at Glacier that summer instead of on an archaeology dig, which is how I'd spent the previous three summers. I had given up on the anthropology archaeology major, and it was sort of an existential crisis moment in my life where I retreated to the wilderness. So that clarified everything. I was keeping a journal for the first time in my life. I was writing all these poems, as I said, and then she gave me that push. So it was that next semester when I took my first creative writing class.
Wow.
Just all throughout my life, it's been my mother who's pushed horror novels into my hands, for better or worse. It's been teachers who inspired me to read, say, the Writers of the She trilogy, or to read books like The Crystal Cave, or books like The Jungle, or books that even challenged my notion of what storytelling was. The Old Man and the Sea, which I couldn't stand at the time when I read it. Mrs. O'Shea made me read that one, and I just couldn't understand how this was a story. I love it now, but it seems so drawn out and boring at the time. The Awakening by Kate Chopin. I've always had these people shoving books into my hands and saying, "You must read this," and I always walk away changed. And to this day, all of my bosses are women, in a way. Like my agent, Catherine Fawcett, I've worked with her since 2004. Helen Atzma, who was my editor at Grand Central, hashtag now at Houghton Mifflin. Fiona McCray at Grey Wolf Press. And I have, all these really strong, super smart female figures in my life who are saying, "Do this, don't do that," and, I'm a better writer and man because of it.
And way back in 2008, Ben, I first encountered your writing, and you were kind of this same sort of encouragement for me. It was actually some of your nonfiction, an essay titled Bottles in a Midnight Sea, that was part of a special issue on literary magazines in the Mississippi Review. That essay served as such encouragement to me and lit the path ahead by someone who had gone the distance. I'd like to close by having you read that essay.
Sure, yeah. I have not looked at this since I published it, I don't know, years ago, so here we go. I have slaughtered thousands of trees. Sometimes, late at night, when shadows play across the ceiling and sleep escapes me, I think about all the stories my printer has laid gently in its tray. All the manila envelopes, shoved full, licked, pressed, stamped, then padded for good luck. All the rejection letters that snuck into my mailbox when my back was turned. And I feel a certain nervousness, imagining the dark forest that awaits me on the other side, eager to root through my bones and knock me about with its branches. This dreadful nervousness, the nervousness brought on by piles of papery carcasses, assaults all writers. It is seated in insecurity. No matter how hard we work, no matter how much or how long we write, no one will care. No one will run their eyes lovingly across the black letters we have stitched on white paper. All those hours we spent locked away from the zoo, the bar, the world, all for nothing. Without an audience, whether a teacher or a parent or a workshop or a magazine subscriber or a book club, a writer's impotence. Don't pretend to tell me you write purely for yourself. That's hippie talk. Think of what we do. We close the door and sit alone, hunched over a keyboard, our fingers poised as if ready to cast some spell. Sometimes we type, more often we think, and sip from our stained coffee mug and chew our fingernails and pick at our scabs. We wear ill-fitting jeans. We need haircuts. We have squashy bellies. We talk to ourselves. It is a miserable existence, not so different than that of a gibbering lunatic who wanders his cell and fumbles vaguely with his genitals. Alone. We are alone. And the literary journal is not only an antidote to our loneliness, it is the very reason we write. The lunatic shakes the bars of his cell, or howls from a street corner, or scrawls bloody messages on a bathroom stall because he wants to be heard. I remember the rejection letters I used to receive as a grad student, the ones with some encouraging message scribbled across their bottom, advising me to shift the point of view or expand the backstory, or, to keep trying, in other words. I tacked these notes to my office door and read them countless times, because someone had heard me. Someone was out there. And when this very journal sent me my very first acceptance letter, I drank my way through a six-pack of Coors and danced to Leonard Skinner in my living room. I was so thrilled. Because I wasn't alone after all, I realized. Over time, now that acceptance has become the rule rather than the exception, the thrill has certainly lessened. But my objective and determination remain the same. I am the lonely madman crumpling messages into bottles and sending them off into a midnight sea. Every response seems a miracle. Every publication makes me more and more gratefully aware of this community we belong to, all of us hidden away, only occasionally showing our faces, but engaged in an intimate, sacred togetherness made possible by journals whose pages serve as ink.
Thank you. Thank you, Ben, for reading that and for talking with me today.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Benjamin Percy is the author of the new collection of essays, Thrill Me. You've been listening to Book Central. I'm your host, Chris Viviora. Our theme music was composed by Will Pett.